when they said someone needed to, I kind of battered down the door. It really is a privilege and an honour and all the things that people say. Because as a formerly young Greenbelter with an interest in music and words and faith and mystery and culture and how it all fits together and how the fragmented cry of the heart becomes something in pop culture that we recognise as the divine, Steve has been a guiding light, really. I've always kept my distance from him because I've been intimidated, actually. That's the truth. You don't need people like me hanging around when you're, just trying to get on. I'm talking about the former me now, 10 years ago. Now, obviously, we'd be best of friends. Because we all need people to show us the way, and often in a sort of isolated and lonely way, I suspect. Steve's been doing that work, and some of his writing for me, Hungry for Heaven was a particularly transformational book. But the other books, including Johnny Cash and Marvin Gaye, have just been staggering pieces of work. He's interviewed everybody in the world ever who was any good. And he's now turned his attention to the Beatles, which is a bit like attempting a biography of God, I would have thought, but there we are. And he'll be doing signings at 7 o'clock today and 4:30 tomorrow for the important business of selling you things in the bookshop. I just bow in deference and give you Steve Turner.
Okay, is that picking up okay? Yeah, too quiet. Too quiet. Right. Was he? Hello? Goodbye? Oh, okay. It's a Beatles joke. Yeah, so 40 years ago, is that still picking up okay?
Yeah.
40 years ago this month, the Beatles were on their last tour ever, and they were in America, and this controversy blew up where John was quoted as saying that the Beatles were more popular than Jesus. This was a comment he'd made to the Evening Standard, to Maureen Cleave of the Evening Standard, some months before, and it had been published in the Evening Standard, hadn't caused a controversy at all, but reproduced in an American teenage magazine and then sent out to disc jockeys. I found that they were sent out specifically to disc jockeys that they thought would get enraged, and they did get enraged. And a couple of them in Birmingham, Alabama, announced they were going to ban all Beatles records, and they in fact announced burnings of Beatle memorabilia and records. And another thing I found out was that it was only because a UPI reporter was in a car in Birmingham, Alabama, and heard them make this announcement, and he put it on the wire service. And so that thing that would just have been a little local kerfuffle actually spread not only throughout America but throughout the world. And there were big fears about the Beatles' safety. And Brian Epstein flew over to New York, Brian Epstein, the Beatles' manager, because there was consideration that the whole tour would be pulled off. It's interesting because John also went on to say, I don't know which is going to go first, rock and roll or Christianity, which in 1966 was a very unusual thing to say because it was prior to what we think of as rock culture, festivals like Woodstock, when people could see a kind of a religious dimension to rock music. In 1966, I mean, rock music still was sort of pop music, grown a little more sophisticated and complicated, but essentially pop music. And so to compare yourself to Jesus or to compare rock and roll to Christianity was a very unusual thing to do. But I think he had a point. The unfortunate thing in America was that they didn't really listen to what he said and evaluate it, but they just condemned him for mentioning the Beatles and Jesus in the same sentence. But he said that Christianity was shrinking and that rock and roll was expanding, and that was true. His generation, for example, something like 39% of people born in the early 1940s went to Sunday school. In the early 60s, it was down to 29%. This may just be the Church of England, but the most recent figure was something like 2%. So he was right if he was talking about the Church of England within England, and that actually was his experience of Christianity. He didn't really know other denominations, certainly didn't know Christianity in other cultures. My book, The Beatles, The Gospel According to the Beatles, makes the case that the Beatles, not just through their music, but through their lifestyle, through the things they said in interviews, through the things they recommended, did have, in effect, what you could call a gospel. Although this was often implicit rather than explicit, it was nevertheless a really important part of who they were. And I would suggest that it was such an important part that I don't think they would have had the impact that they did have if they hadn't have had that dimension to who they were. They reached a generation that was becoming detached from Christianity, from the Christian story. The Christian story no longer gripped the imagination of the particular generation they came from and the one beneath them that this music was directed at. So on the one hand, there was a sense of freedom in that generation. But on the other hand, there was a sense that they needed guidance and they needed values. And they were looking for transcendent experiences. And I think for a while, the Beatles became, if you like, spiritual leaders of this particular generation. And I think it's for that reason that from at least 1965 onwards, many of their songs adopted the tone of what you might call a sermonette. If you think of the song The Word, it says, "Say the word and be like me." I mean, this is John sort of reaching out and trying to instruct people. In the song Rain, "Can you hear me?" Strawberry Fields of Forever, of course, "So let me take you down." This is John taking on the role of a leader and using the language of a leader. Any gospel, and by the way, I'm really using the word gospel to mean the message, the worldview, you know, what the Beatles were saying, what they were all about. Any gospel presupposes that there's something wrong with the world and or something wrong with us as individuals. So gospel, according to Karl Marx, he would say it's the class system that's wrong. It's the ownership of the means of production. That's what's wrong with society. And of course, in the Christian gospel, what's wrong is sin, whether it's individual or corporate. For the Beatles, what was wrong with the world was the inability to see clearly. It was a problem of perception or a problem of limited vision. Because our vision was limited, we didn't enjoy life to the fullest. We didn't appreciate the full range of possibilities open to us, whether that's creative possibilities or lifestyle choices or moral options or even levels, different levels of consciousness. And I think the problem's probably best stated in their song Nowhere Man, which came on the 1965 album Rubber Soul, which was really the kind of the breakthrough album as far as them changing from the kind of Beatlemania pop music. Mostly everything before Rubber Soul was really songs about love in one way or another. And then with Rubber Soul, you start getting songs about other things. You still get love songs, but you're getting a lot of other things coming in. Nowhere Man, if you remember, he's living in his nowhere land, and he's making all his nowhere plans for nobody. And his problem is, he's as blind as he can be, just sees what he wants to see. So that's the problem. Our vision is limited because we decide what we're going to see. And that's all we see. So, Nowhere Man. So that idea of blindness, which we might think of as spiritual blindness, comes up in a lot of other songs. There's a song of George's called Think for Yourself, when he's addressing somebody who is telling him lies about what he says, the good things that we can have if we close our eyes. So there's this kind of idea that, you know, you can kind of get along in life, you can have a good time, as long as you keep that kind of blinkered view, but that's not what they want. And George's song seems to be an early version of what John would say later in Strawberry Fields Forever, which came 2 years later. Living is easy with Misunderstanding all you see. It's the same idea. Living is easy with eyes closed. Misunderstanding all you see. For a long time, I thought he was recommending that. I thought that was part of going down to Strawberry Fields, but it's actually the opposite. That's what he's trying to guide people away from. And this is put a number of different ways in a number of different songs, but the problem's always the same. Without a change of perception, without a change of mind, you cannot be enlightened. I think John was probably the most specific about this problem and about what needed to happen if you were to change it. And he really said it all in a song in 1966, which was called Rain, and it was the B-side of Paperback Writer. And what he says is that essentially we shouldn't be controlled by outside events, because it's really what's in our heads, it's what's in our minds that's most important. And if we could change our perceptions, maybe even the bad things would appear good. He uses the example of rain. And I certainly wouldn't have known what he was talking about when I first heard this record in 66. The thing that I remember noticing at the time is because it was the first time they'd used Batwood guitars on a record. So it just sounded like a really strange sound at the time. You kind of knew something different was happening with the Beatles. But he says, if the rain comes, they run and hide their heads. They might as well be dead. If the rain comes. When the sun shines, they slip into the shade and sip their lemonade. When the sun shines. So, you know, we feel bad when it rains, we feel good when it's sunny. But he says, rain, I don't mind. Shine, the weather's fine. I can show you that when it starts to rain, everything's the same. I can show you. Rain, I don't mind. Shine, the weather's fine. Can you hear me that when it rains and shines, it's just a state of mind? Can you hear me? Okay, so that's the kind of the problem stated and the solution hinted at. But how did the Beatles recommend that we could change our minds? I would say up until 1965, they didn't really deal with it in theory at all. If you've got any images of the Beatles prior to 65, it's probably like A Hard Day's Night with lots of girls screaming and lots of good time music on stage. But I think in a way that was part of the same message, because with their music they kind of changed perceptions, they changed people's behaviour. And I think in a way the girls, the girls that screamed at the Beatles were really in the vanguard of all that, because they went into a theatre or an auditorium and they, for the duration of that concert, I mean, their minds were changed. They were behaving in a way that was really sort of forbidden for them in any other circumstance. But they went into that place and they reacted to the Beatles and they screamed and they wailed and they fainted and they behaved in a way that was completely, really inappropriate for a young girl of the time. And then they went home and kind of turned off their behaviour. Of course, people did notice and draw similarities between the ecstatic behaviour of these girls at the concerts and ecstatic behaviour in primitive religious rituals, which also used music and drums. And you could see the looks on the faces were often very similar. So people started to think, well, maybe there is a kind of a spiritual dimension to what they're doing. I think what the Beatles were best known for at the time is certainly sort of keeping their minds out of any kind of rut. And I'm thinking of that particularly in terms of creativity. The Beatles always challenged when anybody said, well, you can't do that, that's never been done before. They always said, well, why not? And the whole history of their recording career is really saying, well, why not? And so breaking out of that kind of mental rut that people tend to get into. Like thinking a single has to be less than 2 minutes, 59 seconds. And they would say, well, why, you know, why can't a song start with a crashing chord, or why can't it start with a chorus? And they were, you know, why can't you have an African drum? Why can't you have a sitar? They were always pushing things. And it was all part of this kind of mental expansion. I think in another way that you noticed the way they were thinking was in their press conferences. if you ever see any Elvis or somebody doing a press conference, it was always a question was asked and a polite answer was given and so on. But the Beatles press conferences were surreal experiences because they didn't always answer the question. They dealt in wordplay and word association. And I think, again, it was this, in embryo form, it was this idea of letting your mind go free rather than just sort of following the narrow rut that people expected you to go along. At the end of 1964, the Beatles discovered pot. They'd experienced amphetamines mostly amphetamines when they were in Hamburg. But they discovered pot at the end of 1964. And that seemed to encourage this journey of exploration and this belief in changing your consciousness. They were introduced to the drug by, there was a group of people involved, but Bob Dylan was certainly one of them. And a guy called Al Aronowitz, who was a writer for the New York Post, who knew Allen Ginsberg, the poet, who knew Bob Dylan, who knew the Beatles. And he delighted in introducing people, and he wanted to get the Beatles turned on. That was his big dream. He thought pot was the best thing, had happened to him in his life, and he definitely wanted the Beatles to get turned on. He figured that they would somehow spread this message through their music. Here's a song of the Beatles, but it's actually written by Paul. You'll probably recognize it, but I'll talk a bit about it afterwards. Got to Get You Into My Life, which until 3 or 4 years ago I thought was about a girl, but Paul in his autobiography admitted that it was actually a song to pot. So what he wanted to get into his life was the drug. I was alone. I took a ride. I didn't know what I would find there. Another road where maybe I could see another kind of mind there. So again, you're getting this idea of the different mind. It's quite funny, really. Paul was probably the most enthusiastic about pot. He smoked it in this hotel room, and he got... It was such a new experience to him that he thought he'd solved all the problems in life. And he asked Mal Evans, who was the Beatles' road manager, he asked if he had a piece of paper because he wanted to write down what the answer to life was. And he wrote it down, and then because he came down the next day and asked Mal to produce this bit of paper, which he did, and all was written on the paper was, there are seven levels. But anyway, he thought he knew. That was the point. He just knew that he knew. It was this kind of experience for him. So again, it's this mental transformation, another kind of mind. A few months later, early in 1965, John Lennon and George Harrison, were given LSD by their dentist. They probably charged extra for it. No, they had a meal with their dentist, a private dentist. And during this party, he put it into their coffee and didn't tell them. And it was, I talked to Patty Boyd and I talked to Cynthia Lennon about this, and they were very distressed about it, as you might be, because, because everything just went distorted, colours became more brilliant. And Patty said to me, I just thought I was going mad and that I would always be this way, that I was kind of stuck in this madness and I'd never get out of it. John and George actually enjoyed the experience. It was a bit disorientating at first, but then they went to a nightclub and they felt infused with feelings of love, same effect that ecstasy apparently has, where people just feel this sort of lovingness, which like this kind of universal feeling of love. But it also made them doubt the validity of everything they'd been told before. It seemed like everything that they learned as they grew up was kind of provisional, because there were many other ways of seeing things. And it made them feel that time had stopped and that all you had to live for was the permanent now. It also led them to believe that William James, who was a writer in the 19th century, who wrote a book about the varieties of religious experience, and he talked about what he called normal waking consciousness, which is what I hope most of you are in at the moment. It certainly looks like it. And normal waking consciousness is just one of many types of consciousness available to us. And, you know, through religious experience, through drugs, through many other things, we could experience different forms of consciousness. The way we see the world normally is just one amongst many ways of looking at the world. I believe, as a result of my research, that the next song they recorded after taking LSD was Help. I can't say for absolutely definite, but I tried to find out. I did get Patty to go through her diaries for 1965 to see exactly when this momentous occasion was, but she'd recorded all her sort of modelling engagements, things like that, but hadn't this visit to the dentist hadn't gone down in her book. But I'm fairly convinced it was in, I think it's April 1965, which would make Help the next song they recorded. And I find that very interesting because when I first saw the film Help and first heard the song Help, it just sounded like a jolly sort of Beatles song. And then John would often talk about it being a song about his own inner anxieties, the first song in where he'd really exposed himself. But when I listened to it in the light of the drug experience, I began to think that was what it was about. When I was younger, so much younger than today, I never needed anybody's help in any way. But now these days are gone, I'm not so self-assured. Now I find I've changed my mind. I've opened up the doors. I think looking at it in the light of a drug experience made sense, certainly, of changed my mind, meaning not just I've reversed my decision, but I've actually changed my mind. I've changed my consciousness. And also opened up the doors, which is a very strange expression to use in a Beatles song. I think he might have been referring to Aldous Huxley's book, The Doors of Perception, which was written in the 1950s, and it was about Aldous Huxley was a British novelist living out in California. He experimented with drugs, and The Doors of Perception was an account of one of the trips that he'd taken. And in itself, The Doors of Perception is a reference to a line from a poem by William Blake. And I think William Blake's quite important. The two poets that I think have a relevant literary connection to the Beatles are William Wordsworth on the one hand and William Blake on the other. Blake was writing in the late 18th century, and he thought our perceptions had been limited by the teachings of the Enlightenment that dismissed the spiritual. And Blake believed in direct spiritual experience that defied rational explanation. And he too felt that there were other levels of consciousness available to us, and that our experience of reality could be enlarged. In The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, he wrote these lines, and this is where this phrase, The Doors of Perception, comes from. And if you're interested, the Los Angeles band The Doors, that's where they got, that's why they called themselves The Doors. I don't know whether it was from Huxley or whether it was directly from Blake. So The Marriage of Heaven and Hell. If the doors of perception were cleansed, everything would appear to man as it is, infinite. For man has closed himself up till he sees all things through narrow chinks of his cavern. So if you can see, Blake's saying a very similar thing to what I think the Beatles were saying, that we needed the doors of our perception to be cleansed, or John says opened, because we're closed up. We're just like looking through bars of a prison, and we need everything to be prized open. It was specifically through their experience of LSD that they became interested in Eastern religion, because concepts in Hinduism such as Maya, the idea that the world is illusory, or Brahman, the idea that God is another word for like everything there is, we're all a part of the Godhead, or even the Buddhist idea of Satori, of a sudden enlightenment, these things suddenly came to make sense to them. Timothy Leary, who was characterized as being the high priest of LSD in the 1960s. He was the one that made the phrase up, turn on, tune in, and drop out, if you remember. He was a psychologist at Harvard, and then he discovered LSD. He left Harvard, became a great champion of LSD through talks, through television appearances, through books. And he was very eager to establish a drug-based religion. And he would explain the LSD experience using the terminology of the East. So that made, again, Eastern literature more accessible to people like the Beatles. Leary paraphrased the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which was a book written supposedly to guide people through the stages of death so that they had a good death. And this part of this paraphrase, John Lennon turned into the song Tomorrow Never Knows. Because LSD was, in a sense, a form of death. It was your ego was dying, your old way of seeing things was dying. The ego had to go. Turn off your mind, relax and float downstream. It is not dying, it is not dying. Lay down all thought, surrender to the void. It is shining, it is shining. John didn't really alter Leary's words very much at all. This song, you can imagine hearing this in 1966. This was just after their final tour and just after the More Popular Than Jesus controversy. And it was the most unusual track I think any of us had ever heard, probably any of us had ever heard, let alone by the Beatles. My book, The Gospel According to the Beatles, isn't all about religious exploration, but because they were looking for this kind of altered consciousness, they were naturally drawn to religion, and they actually were naturally drawn to religions that offered an altered form of consciousness as part of the deal, if you like. They weren't particularly interested in religions that had a kind of an external god or a spiritual world, but religions that did something to your mind. In 1967, famously, they had contact with the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. They went to a lecture of his in London at the Hilton Hotel, all four of them. And then early the next year, 1968, they all went out to India, studying at the ashram, the place where they learnt meditation in Rishikesh. And they studied there for several weeks. They're each given a personal mantra, which is like a personal sound, a word that you would repeat again and again and again and again until your mind, the theory is that you go down to the deepest level of consciousness. You kind of join the universal consciousness. And the Beatles would meditate for hours. And while they were in India, they wrote a large portion of what's called the White Album. Actually, the real title is The Beatles, but it has a white cover. It's always referred to as the White Album. It's a double album. Most of those songs were written out in India. However, it's very interesting. They never wrote a song about transcendental meditation. The Beach Boys did. Mike Love of the Beach Boys went to India, and they actually wrote a song called the TM song, which was a kind of a gospel song, if you like, for the Maharishi and TM. But the influence of meditation, I think, had two specific results on the Beatles' music. Firstly, it seemed to simplify their music. I guess as you meditate, as your mind becomes less cluttered, you probably naturally want to write music that's less cluttered. And after Sgt. Pepper, which was a very convoluted, a psychedelic sort of sound, they went for something that was very simple, like songs like Blackbird with just an acoustic guitar, things seemed to be sort of stripped down. And it's interesting going from a very complicated album cover like the Sgt. Pepper thing with the multitude of faces on the cover, they went to the plain white cover for the White Album. Secondly, I think after discovering the power of the mantra, the power of a single repeated sound to change the consciousness, they did use that technique on the end of several of their songs. Think of at the end of I Am the Walrus, the goo goo gajoob sound, or the end of Hello Goodbye, the hey la hey lo helloa, or the end of Hey Jude, just that la 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 that just goes on and on and on. They did admit that being introduced to the concept of the mantra interested them in the power of repeated sounds. They did specifically say that they wanted their beliefs to affect their music unconsciously rather than consciously. After their time in India, they kind of really divided. George became captivated by the Hare Krishna movement, which was slightly different to transcendental meditation and actually different to most mainstream Hindu beliefs. It actually has a personal god, Krishna, who they really believe exist and that you can pray to. So when George sings My Sweet Lord, he's actually addressing Krishna as we would address Jesus. The Radha Krishna Temple recorded the Hare Krishna mantra for the Beatles label, for the Apple label. And George constantly tried to work out his beliefs in his songs. For example, While My Guitar Gently Weeps, he got the Gently Weeps part of that title, well, he got the title from tossing the I Ching and going to a random page in a book and just putting his finger on a word in the book. And he actually put his finger on and lifted it up and it had the words Gently Weeps. And so he wrote the song based on that technique. I, Me, Me, Mine, which was on the Let It Be album, was his view of the problems of the ego. It's very difficult being somebody following a religion that told him to lose his ego and being in a business like show business where the ego is very important. And I think that started his disillusionment with being in the Beatles. I guess his most explicit expression of his faith would be Within You Without You on the Sgt. Pepper album. Or the Inner Light, which is the B-side of Lady Madonna. The Inner Light is a paraphrase of the Tao Te Ching, or part of the Tao Te Ching. And it expressed their view that what you should be doing is all within your head. You didn't need to go out searching. It was all within yourself. Without going out of my door, I can know all things on earth. Without looking out of my window, I can know the ways of heaven. The farther one travels, the less one knows. The less one really knows. Paul McCartney was always quite pragmatic about his sort of forays into religion and into drugs. When he took LSD, he went public. He was the first one in the Beatles to go public, which I think annoyed John and George, as they'd actually been the first ones to do it. And he was telling journalists that he'd seen God while he was on LSD, and that every minister in the country should take it, and the church would be turned around. But he didn't say things like that for very long. Meditation. He left the Maharishi's camp. Well, Ringo was the first one out because there were no baked beans, and he didn't like the flies. But Paul was next out, and he really ended up talking about meditation in purely practical terms, like, you know, it probably made good business sense. You did a hard day's work, and at the end you could kind of unwind with a bit of meditation. But he didn't really talk about it in the divine sense, or even talk about sort of getting to the root of consciousness or anything like that. John always retained his interest in altered forms of consciousness. But he never really had any time for religious orthodoxy of any kind or for spiritual leaders. Almost as soon as he left India, he became disenchanted with the Maharishi. And in fact, the song Sexy Sadie, which was on the White Album, was actually a put-down of the Maharishi. It was originally called Maharishi, What Have You Done? You Made a Fool of Everyone. And then they changed it, thinking that might be considered libelous. It was around this time that John met Yoko Ono, and I think he was exposed to some of the ideas behind Zen Buddhism at this time. And Zen Buddhism really suited John's temperament, because Zen Buddhism doesn't require belief in a god, and it really does rely on different techniques which kind of snap your mind in a certain way and stop you gripping onto normal consciousness. So that was something that was of very great interest to John. And I think his songs after that reflected that kind of simplicity of Zen art. And his final statement that I could find on his religious beliefs was in a letter to his cousin in 1979, where he said to her, "I'm a pagan," and then he qualified that by saying, "I'm a Zen pagan." So what can we learn from the Beatles? I think one thing we can learn is that we can expand our minds, not in the ways that they were recommending, but that idea of not going down the kind of the well-worn ruts. That was what it was exciting about the Beatles. They changed things, not just for music at that time, but I think their impact just has gone on and on and on. Because they just raise that question all the time, like, well, why should things be this way? And sometimes we can be very unimaginative, and if I was to cite one example, I mean, just a couple of days ago, I was in a Christian bookstore in London, and I thought, why is this so boring? Why is, like, I mean, bookshops have gone a long way since the 1950s, but this bookshop hadn't. And, you know, if we do things in an unimaginative way, if we're just going along these deep ruts, we are actually saying that we whatever we believe in is unimaginative and is very limited in its possibilities. And so I think it is a challenge to us. There was I saw a photograph of a kid that had obviously been dragged along to some protest about the Beatles. And he must have only been 5 or 6 years old. And he had a big poster, and it said, "The Beatles are dull and unexciting." And I thought, I mean, you could say a lot of things about the Beatles, but that wouldn't be one of them. But unfortunately, a lot of things associated with Christianity, you probably could have a big placard like that, and it would be quite accurate. And it's a shame, because it doesn't need to be that way. Unfortunately, things like Greenbelt have come along and shown people that things don't have to be dull. Secondly, I like the way the Beatles incorporated their beliefs in a very natural way. They didn't sit down with a thesis in one hand and then write a song that was some sort of artistic expression of this thesis. Their beliefs, I kind of feel that their beliefs soaked into their imaginations and then sort of naturally came out in their songs. And that's what I'm always trying to encourage Christians to do. You know, a piece of art isn't just some more accessible way of putting over some rather dull thesis. It should be something that sort of soaks through our lives and just comes out in a natural way, almost like we can't help it coming out. I'd give as an example of the way that the Beatles kind of played with ideas that could be quite profound, but would come out in a different way, and they were probably not even conscious of it at the time. For example, the song Hello Goodbye came out of Paul's interest in the Buddhist idea of yin and yang, the theory of opposites. But he didn't write a track, so he didn't try and hector people. He just wrote a fairly playful song that involved opposites. When George Harrison was asked in 1968 whether he'd now be writing songs about meditation, he said, "I'd rather not use any obvious things until you can see how it's naturally affected the music." And responding to the same question, John said, "The same as we didn't really shove our LP full of pot and drugs, but there was an effect. We were more consciously trying to keep it out. We wouldn't say, 'I had some acid, baby, so groovy.' But there was a feeling that something had happened between Revolver and Sgt. Pepper." So I think that's something that we could learn. There's that natural way of letting one's beliefs affect our art. And thirdly, the Beatles certainly expanded the vocabulary of rock music. They allowed a discussion of spiritual issues. You know, traditionally, rock music had been about, obviously, girls and jukeboxes and parties and cars and whatever. But they, in their career, you saw from 1965 onwards just the expansion of things. Some of these songs that I've played, you'd never have set the Tao Te Ching to music in, you know, 1962 or 1958. They just allowed that possibility. So they allowed us to discuss many more things in rock music. And certainly without the Beatles, I don't think there would be a U2, and without the Beatles, I doubt whether there would be a Greenbelt Festival, really. I think Greenbelt has kind of grown out of that mentality. So that's my time of talking about my book, and I'm hoping that some of you might have some questions as well, because there's so many things to say, and it's hard to sort of stuff them all in one talk, because my book begins with the More Popular Than Jesus incident, then it goes into the Beatles' childhood, looking at what religious influences they had in their childhood and their church backgrounds, and then to art college and Hamburg and the influence of existentialism, and then into drugs, the East, right up to the end of their career, and then into their solo careers. So, for example, John got into all different sorts of things in the 70s, astrology, numerology, and even had a couple of bouts with born-again Christianity. I was interested to find some correspondence he'd had with the American television evangelist Oral Roberts, where he'd written to him and said, you know, can Christianity do anything for me? And I'm so messed up on drugs, etc. Then there was a period in the late 70s when he got interested in Pat Robertson, the 700 Club, and he was influenced by the Zeffirelli film, the Zeffirelli film about Jesus. And but it apparently only lasted a couple of months because I think Yoko was quite controlling, and I think she could see if he became a Christian, his allegiance wouldn't be to her psychics and numerologists, but would be elsewhere. Very interesting how he would constantly compare himself to Jesus, not only with the more popular than Jesus, but there's another time when he went into Apple office. He'd obviously been tripping, but he went in and said that he was Jesus come back and wanted an announcement put out, which they didn't. But the fact that Jesus was a kind of a reference point for him, and what was his final interview, he told the interviewer that he was always finding new things in the Bible, and that the parables of that as he read them now meant so much more to him than when he was a kid going to Sunday school. So there's a whole lot more things to talk about. And then I finished the book with a kind of a personal thing about myself, how the Beatles affected me. We sort of blithely talk about how the Beatles affected the world and affected a generation, but it's very hard to put your finger on exactly how that happened. So the only way I knew how to do that was to talk about how they'd affected me. And in that final chapter, I mention an interview that I did with John and Yoko when the subject of Jesus came up, and we had a long talk about it. So the book kind of rounds off in a very personal way with me reacting with John Lennon. So, any questions?
We don't have roving mics. If anybody gives a question,
Okay.
Can you just repeat a bit so
okay.
People at the back and repeat?
Right. Jimmy Savile never had it like this. Yeah. Yeah.
I suppose my question is where do we find a balance between an idealistic Beatles world and then conservative Christian world?
Right. Okay, the question is, you know, the Beatles did experimented a lot and kind of pushed the boundaries of music. The music scene that Christians control tends to be naturally very conservative, so how do you... how do you encourage experimentation in an area that tends to be naturally conservative? Because you mentioned like some people saying something's demonic. I think that's probably, that raises a lot of problems if somebody's going to say like a particular style of music or progression of chords or something is somehow the devil's got the copyright on that. You can't use that. That would be very problematic. I mean, if you think of God as creator, he was pretty playful and, when you look at the variety in the world and things which you look at and think, I can't see the use for that, you know, some things must be just decorative and you've only got to look. I remember being in Israel, there's some sort of viewing place, I can't remember the correct term for it, but you go under the water and you can see the fish. And I remember being just staggered at the variety of fish and the variety of colours, and just get some idea of the playfulness of God, and you almost get this idea of him trying something. You think, yeah, that's quite good, and then and just going on and on and on. A bit like Picasso would do with he'd go through these phases when he'd want to paint, I don't know, some goddess or a fish or whatever, and he would just go on and on and on, and then he'd get tired of that and go on to something else. I think we should have that sort of attitude, really. The only limitation really is sinfulness. I think within that you've got complete freedom. Right at the back. Yes. Sorry. Yeah. Right. Right.
I was just wondering,
Okay. Yeah, talking about a couple of the songs that might have a hymnal quality, like Let It Be and Free As a Bird. I don't know so much about Free As a Bird, but Paul said in an interview that when he first started, because he'd done a little stint as a choir boy at a church called St. Barnabas in Liverpool, and he had tried out for the Liverpool Cathedral Choir and hadn't got in. So he did know about hymns, and when he first started to write songs, people used to say, that sounds a bit like a hymn, and that sort of shocked him and would make him go back and write some more. But I think Let It Be, it probably is the most hymn-like song of theirs, because it does mention Mother Mary. Actually, that's Paul. The genesis of the song was he had a dream where his mother, who was a Catholic, and whose name was Mary, had come to him and said, you know, let it be, just let things go. Because this was the time when everything was going bad at Apple and the Beatles were breaking up. But also, he was aware, because he referred to the song as being quasi-religious, he was aware, having a Catholic mother, that, Mother Mary would have that kind of resonance. And also the phrase, let it be, is very similar to what Mary says in the Magnificat. So, but of course, let it be can have Buddhist connotations of, just let things go, just let go. So I guess he was aware that it had those dimensions. And then when they recorded it, they have Billy Preston on organ, and Billy Preston used to belong to the Church of God in Christ. I think he sang in a group with Andre Crouch many, many years ago. So he had that kind of gospel background, and he knew how to play those gospel keyboards. So I guess putting all those things together, it did have a sort of hymn-like quality. When I first started on the book, I mentioned to a guy in Liverpool who's quite a Beatles expert. I said, I'm doing this book called The Gospel According to the Beatles. And he kind of thought a while and said, I see what you mean, like Let It Be, as if I was going to base a whole book on Let It Be. But that, I think that is the song people think about when they, if you think religious and Beatles, they think of that song. But that's sometimes because people have a limited idea of what religion and spirituality incorporates, because it goes through so many of their songs in different ways and different aspects without being sort of on the nose. Yes?
The comparison you make with Blake and John Lennon seems to me extraordinarily fertile, because Blake pushes us in really exciting directions and shocks us. I mean, says things like Jesus died an unbeliever, but actually when you unpack that, you see there's an awful lot of truth in that. And I've always thought that Imagine, which you haven't mentioned, but
probably
seems to be profoundly Christian. All I've ever read about Imagine from a Christian context has criticised it, has not understood the thing about Imagine, no religion. But actually, when you look at the kind of vision of the kingdom of God, I mean, when we get there, there is no religion, and there's no war, and we all have things in common. It seems profoundly Christian. You know, what do you think?
Oh, this guy's got a very generous opinion of Imagine down here. He thinks it's... It's a good one, that. It could be about the future kingdom, he says. Well, John did say it was an atheistic song. It was quite interesting because he did a song called God on his first solo album, and it says, I don't believe in, I don't believe in Elvis, I don't believe in Jesus, I don't believe in Buddha. And he went on to say that people wouldn't accept that, that wouldn't have become a popular song, it was too direct. But he said if you put some sort of candy coating on it, then it would sell, which is what he did with Imagine. Because I don't know if you remember, just recently there was a church where, it was a school where they were going to sing it in the assembly, and it was a Church of England school, and the headmaster thought it might not be a good idea. And there were these people saying, how mean. But, John had written it as a knock against Christianity, and I guess sort of an idealistic thing, thinking that religion leads to all the problems in the world. I had to do an interview yesterday in Liverpool, BBC Radio Merseyside, and I didn't know who I was going to be on with, but I was on with there's a guy called Jackie Lomax who recorded for the Apple label. He used to be in a group called The Undertakers in Liverpool. And he said he was obviously quite hotly against religion, and he said, you know, they should ban religion for 10 years and see what would happen. And I didn't think quick enough because, I mean, that's what they did in China and that's what they did in Russia. And it led to the, you know, the biggest killings by any leader ever. You know, if you look at the history of the 20th century, the biggest, greatest loss of life has been under Mao and Stalin. So, you know, people that think that no religion would lead to, you know, a great state of affairs, I think, haven't done their research. Yeah. Anybody with a hand up? Yeah.
this isn't about the Beatles, that's sort of what I'm saying.
Right.
I know it sounds like it's written about the idea of an eternal note.
Yeah.
That creates and destroys, that's essential to destroy the universe. And I know you've written yourself about the idea of a voice of redemption within popular music.
Yeah.
And I just wondered if you'd comment on
that. Yeah. Yeah, I know Pete Townsend's written about that, and I've interviewed Pete Townsend. I can't, some of his ideas I can't fully understand, but, what? Oh, sorry. Okay, the gentleman was saying that Pete Townsend of The Who has talked about there being a kind of an eternal note of music, and I've written about rock music and Search for Redemption, and how do they come together. I think the thing is some people feel that that music is spiritual and that possibly there's some sort of perfect note and it would unify everybody. And Pete, he followed, I don't know how closely he follows him now, but he was following a guru called Mir Barber, and that influenced a lot of his writing on the Tommy album and Who's Next and some of those albums. So certainly Pete is an example of somebody who I guess has benefited from that, all those changes that the Beatles brought about, was able to incorporate spiritual ideas into his music, probably in a far more conscious way with an album like Tommy, which has a very strong, and Quadrophenia as well, which have strongly spiritual themes. But Pete is more like somebody that does actually kind of try and work it through. It doesn't come through in such a natural way, I don't think. Anybody else? Oh, a lady, she's very keen because she's standing up. Yeah. Oh, right. Right. Okay. So the question is, John was certainly during the 70s, great sort of political activist. Well, he was a political activist. And Paul, around the same time, I guess, got into vegetarianism. Yeah, in the book I make the point that I think vegetarianism almost became Paul's sort of gospel. It was a thing that he became most passionate about, most evangelistic about, the thing he would campaign about. I mean, you weren't allowed to go on tour if you... you know, would eat meat in his presence or, you know, on premises that they were in control of and things like that. And they would have these little 3 or 4 minute films at the start of the shows, which are quite graphic about animals being killed. And I think that almost became his kind of cause. And because he has an organic farm. And John's political... Yeah, he became quite active in the sort of late 60s and early 70s. I guess it was all part of this thing of wanting to change the world, wanting to bring about a better world. But of course, as the 70s went on, he didn't do so much after, I guess, about 74 or 75. And he seemed to spend most of his time at home in his apartment in the Dakota Building in New York. And really his window on the world was watching TV. And he, I think that's why he got hooked on these TV evangelists, because that was his... I mean, I was really surprised when somebody said... I heard this rumor that he'd been affected by some Christian teacher, and I thought it would be some, you know, like C.S. Lewis or somebody. And then I found that it was Pat Robertson on the 700 Club. But I guess C.S. Lewis doesn't have a TV show. Yes. This better be the last one, because I think I'm coming up against my deadline. Yeah.
The whole business that Beatles took acid, took drugs, thought they'd seen God or thought they'd had some amazing spiritual experience. I think a lot of people did in the 60s, which changed the whole way they saw the universe and felt they connected with God and it was going to change the world. There's still a lot of people taking acid and taking mind-altering substances, but I get the feeling now that people have seen that it's a dead end in terms of, you know, genuine religious experience. Do you think that music and arts and people experimentation with drugs has just turned into something entirely hedonistic, which is nothing to do with spiritual seeking? Or do you think that people through that kind of experimentation, it does leave people open to questioning?
It's interesting why some people will interpret it as a religious experience or a spiritual experience or whatever, and some people will interpret it just as sort of kicks. And it seems to go in like the whole wave of 60s experimentation was all done within that framework. And I think a lot of it had to do with people like Timothy Leary, who kind of interpreted people's experiences for them, and they did it very much in they would use the language of Eastern religion. So I think it encouraged people to see things in that way. And I wonder if people aren't surrounded by that interpretation and aren't told that that's the effect it's having on them, whether they might just say, I was just having a good time. I mean, the ecstasy generation, they interpreted it maybe religiously in the sense of having a transcendent experience or feeling love for everybody, but not really beyond that. So I think the interpretative literature that surrounds a person when they're going through these experiences must have a lot to do with the kind of spin that people put on it and what they think it's done for them. I think I've run out of time. Thank you for coming along. I felt I was bigger than the Beatles today when I saw you all coming in. Thank you.